Hello and welcome. Welcome to Perimeter Institute's Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas here at Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. It is our pleasure to bring to you our public lecture series presented by Sun Life Financial. Special welcome to both those of you here in the studio audience and to those of you watching online, either on Perimeter's website or one of our many science communication colleagues around the globe. The lecture itself will last approximately 1 hour and will be followed by a question and answer session. However, for those of you online, we have Dr. Damian Pope and Dr. Kelly Foyle and their team of researchers at the ready behind their keyboards in the chat zone, ready to engage in online discussion. They'll answer questions throughout the duration of the lecture. And if you would like to ask a question at the end during the question and answer, please use hashtag PILive. And now, let me introduce tonight's very special guest speaker, Dr. Subir Sachdev. Dr. Sachdev was educated in India before attending MIT and Harvard, where he obtained his PhD in theoretical physics. He held professional positions at Bell Labs and Yale University, where he was a professor of physics before returning to Harvard. He has been awarded several honors, among them membership in the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and the Lorentz Chair at Leiden University. He is also the James Clerk Maxwell Visiting Chair here at Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics. Tonight, he will discuss new experiments in high-temperature superconductivity and explore the unexpected connections between those earthbound experiments and the strange quantum behavior in black holes. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Subir Sachdev.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. It's a real honor to be here, and thank you all for coming. So what you see on the board here, what we call a high-temperature superconductor. This is a picture taken from Scientific American from an article I wrote in January 2003. And the editor of Scientific American came up with this poetic description, which I will read. A superconductor levitated by an unseen magnet in which countless trillions of electrons form a vast interconnected quantum state. Okay, so that sounds like a bit of gobbledygook, but it sounds good anyway. So my purpose here today is to just explain exactly what that means. What is a superconductor? Why does it have trillions of electrons in an interconnected quantum state? And why does it do what it does? So this particular superconductor is a compound called yttrium barium copper oxide. So at this point, your eyes are glazing over. You don't want to be reminded of high school chemistry. Why am I choosing this combination, strange combination of elements? Well, the short answer is we don't know. There's just a few elements, when combined together, form this magical compound called a high-temperature superconductor, meaning that if I take this compound and cool it to liquid nitrogen temperatures. So liquid nitrogen is high temperature as far as I'm concerned, because previously you had to cool it to liquid helium, which required a whole laboratory. But you've all seen liquid nitrogen, and you can just take a crystal of this type, put it in liquid nitrogen, and have it conduct electricity with exactly zero resistance. And it also have a number of interesting properties. And so this was discovered in 1987, and in the intervening 25 plus years, scientists all over the world have been searching for newer compounds with even higher temperatures. But progress has been quite slow. We are still, there's only a handful with which you would be able to do the experiment that I'm now going to show you. So I'm going to walk over here. I'm a theorist, so beware, I might screw things up. but I have in here Okay. Okay, two theorists doing an experiment. All right, so this little thing here is yttrium barium copper oxide. So somebody's baked it carefully in an oven to make this, and I'm just going to put it down here. It's just, you know, looks like It's a ceramic. It feels, you know, just like a black disc, like a piece of chalk. And here I have an ordinary magnet, just a tiny little magnet, and I'm going to put it right on top of this superconductor. Well, that particular compound, can you now, is it, I think, am I standing in front of the camera? That's right. There you go. All right, so there we have a piece of YBCO, as we call this material, with a magnet sitting on top of it. And right now, the YBCO is at room temperature, and it doesn't look very interesting. So now my assistant, Greg, is going to pour some liquid nitrogen. Oops, and you're blocking the camera.
Okay, that was my
so
only
it takes,
job.
So it boils, the liquid nitrogen is boiling off as it cools both the superconductor and the magnet. We don't really need to cool the magnet, so let's just wait a minute while it cools and come back in an hour. No, it should be working in a minute. Okay, all right, so now you see the thing floating. So let's see if I can get this. Am I blocking the camera again? Sorry. Oh, oops.
Oh, perfect.
I got to get it rolling. Oh. All right, physics is fun. Okay, there we go. So now I just want to keep it rolling for a while. There you go. Okay. All right, so what's happening there is as I cooled the superconductor, cooled YBCO, it became a superconductor. And one of the key properties of a superconductor is that it hates magnetic fields. So I put a magnet on top of it, and it wants to expel the magnetic field, and it does it by just lifting the magnet up. Now, if these were two magnets, you know, of course, you might arrange them just so that they repel each other. But if you try that experiment, what will happen? One of the magnets will turn over, and they'll stick. So that doesn't happen with a superconductor, and a superconductor just keeps magnets away. And that property is intimately linked to its ability to conduct electricity without resistance. Effectively, what's happening right now is there are currents flowing in the superconductor, producing a field that's keeping the magnet up. Okay, so we're just going to leave that there and see how long it stays up. But I'll continue my lecture. Okay, so here's another demonstration. A little more elaborate. There's a bunch of magnets on a track, and in that little train car, I should be pointing here, sorry. In this train car, there's liquid nitrogen, and this slab of YBCO has been cooled in that object. And now let me just let the movie move. There you go. So you can see the magnet float, and eventually, when the YBCO float, and eventually it falls on the tracks when it heats up. Here's another picture. Now you put the magnet inside that spaceship and let it go. And so it keeps going you can keep going as long as you keep the superconductor inside the spaceship cool. Okay, so that's good enough for some fun experiments. But the hope is that these materials will actually be useful for something. And there are many, many companies around the world trying to make them practical. So this is a dream to make, this thing. I'm just getting used to this fancy stuff. This is a dream to make cables carrying power between cities. And in this pipe is a cable like this, where you have liquid nitrogen flowing through and coming back, and this little yellow disc is YBCO, and that's carrying the current. And the use of this is that it carries huge amounts of power in a very small space. So the amount of copper wires you need under a dense city like New York could be compressed into a little cable like this. So this is one of the possible applications. Of course, I won't say much more about this today. There are also applications for magnets in MRI machines in cell phone towers and so on. But what drives me and my research of many of my colleagues is simply the question, you know, why is this particular compound, yttrium barium copper oxide, a high-temperature superconductor? So as I said earlier, there's only a few compounds which people happen to have discovered in which I could have done that experiment. YBCO is the most famous one of them. And the short answer is we don't really know, but there have been many studies of these compounds and all of its amazing properties, and we're slowly learning what makes it so special. As you'll see through the course of my lecture, it's really quantum mechanics, the strange properties of quantum mechanics that apply here on macroscopic scales and give you these remarkable phenomena. So anyway, I don't want to deal with this complicated crystal for the rest of my lecture, so hopefully you'll breathe a sigh of relief when I tell you you can focus on just the copper and the oxygen and forget about everything else. So if I sliced a layer here, this is a picture of the copper-oxygen plane. And in fact, you can simplify things even further. There's just one orbital on each copper, if you remember your high school chemistry. This clover leaf shape is an object on which an electron can reside. And so you have a bunch of electrons sitting on these copper sites and moving around the square lattice. So it's a very simply stated problem. What are the quantum mechanical problems? What are the quantum mechanical properties of millions and millions of electrons all sitting on the square lattice and obeying the principles of quantum mechanics? Again, we don't know the answer completely, but we're pretty confident that problem, one of the answers is high-temperature superconductivity. And we're trying to figure out why. So now I'm going to show you, I'll begin with what's called a phase diagram, but don't get scared, I'm going to go back to basics in a minute. It's gone. So we're going to take another look at my favorite superconductor over here and see that now the magnet has come to rest. Oops, okay. Anyway. Okay, well, you can take my word for it. You saw it float. That was the easy part. It's easy to believe that it's at rest. So what we do is we take this material and look at its properties as a function of temperature. The other thing you can do is vary the density of electrons on this square lattice. So what I show here is a phase diagram, and I apologize for starting out at a somewhat technical level. This is a phase diagram as a function of density of electrons on the square lattice and temperature. And here I'm just going to point out that many interesting things can happen, and we are studying a lot of these interesting things mainly because we want to understand why this superconductor is present here all the way up to around 90 Kelvin. That's what we're really interested in and what we want to answer. But to answer that question, we have to look around and see what else is going on. Maybe they'll give us a clue as to what the electrons are doing over here. So among the things that happen around in this phase diagram is something called an antiferromagnet, which I will describe, and something called a strange metal. So that's an unimaginative name for a property we don't understand well. So it's a metal like copper or silver is a metal, but it's strange because it's not exactly the same. All right, we'll come back to that. But one particular point in this phase diagram will play an important role in my discussion is what we call a quantum critical point, and I'll say a bit more about what that means. And this particular point has something called long-range quantum entanglement. So the purpose of the first half hour of my lecture is just to explain what those words mean. And the reason I'm so interested in that question is many of us believe that will be the key to understanding why certain materials become high-temperature superconductors. All right, so that sets the stage. Now we're going to go back to school and start from the basics, literally. So now I'm just going to talk about some very basic principles of quantum mechanics and how they lead to entanglement. Now, you've probably all heard of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. You know, position is uncertain, then momentum is certain. No, with the position, you can't tell where an electron is at any time if you know its momentum and vice versa. I myself can't remember it. So, so that's probably your view of quantum mechanics, at least for some of you. And the first thing I want to tell you, forget that. Quantum mechanics is a very precise and predictive science. But it has some very, very strange properties. And the key strange property is quantum superposition. So I just want to explain what that is. It has no classical analog, so Newton would have no idea what you're talking about, because you can't deform Newton's laws in any way to get quantum superposition. So let me just describe what that is. And the simplest way to describe it is by a famous experiment called the double slit experiment. So here I'm imagining an experiment. We have waves on the surface of water going through these two slits. And as they reach the screen, you get a signature of how high the waves are. And what you do when you do this experiment, what you find is you get what's called an interference pattern, these modulations in the intensity. And they come from the fact that the displacement of the water at any given point is due to two waves, one wave coming from this slit and another wave coming from that slit. So this is just regarded as a classic experiment which tells you that something is a wave. So this is in fact how people understood first that light is a wave, because by making a sufficiently small slit, you could see that interference pattern. But now imagine doing this experiment with electrons. So this is an electron gun of the type that might be found in a TV, in the old TVs, not the flat screen ones. You had an electron gun at the back shooting out electrons, and then you force them to go through two slits. And then if you do this experiment and look at what's happening at the back, you see that the electrons arrive in this distribution that looks very much like a wave pattern. So if you look at this experiment, you say, oh, no big deal, electrons are wave. That's not confusing. I can deal with that. You know, I've never seen an electron, so maybe it's a wave, fine. But it's much more subtle than that. That's not the end of the story. This is quite different from water waves, and the reason it's different is there's a discreteness in what you see on the screen. You really do see the electrons arrive one by one. So when initially the screen is blank, then you see a blip, and then a blip there, and a blip there, and you wait a long time, and eventually you look at the pattern of blips, it looks like an interference pattern. So the fact they arrive one by one, and you see discrete blips, means these are like, you know, billiard balls. On the other hand, when you look at the distribution, they look like waves. So that's, you know, the hard part to absorb. Now you're exposing the subtlety of what quantum mechanics is about. And it raises the question, the key question, you know, which slit did the electron go through? Did it go through the left one or the right one? And if it really was a particle, the answer would have, there would be a simple answer, yes, it either went here or it went there. But if it really went through one or the other slit, you shouldn't see this interference pattern. Because that interference pattern, as I said earlier, is a characteristic property of a wave that goes through both slits. So now you can imagine a thought experiment where you say, okay, I'm going to find out. I'm going to look at the electrons as they go through the two slits and tell you which one did they go through. So I'm going to shine some light here and measure them. So I'm going to say this electron went to this one, that electron went to that one. So you go in and do this experiment. And when you do it, you find everything's fine, but there's no interference pattern. So this is some way where Heisenberg's uncertainty principle comes in. You've measured the position of the electron, and once you've done that, you've kind of destroyed the interference pattern. So that's the subtle and beautiful double slit experiment, first done at the early part of the 20th century, repeated millions and millions of times in many different contexts, and everything I've said is true. So you're led to the unavoidable conclusion is that if you want to think of the electron as a particle that arrives one by one, it must be a particle that passes through both slits. There's no other way to understand the experiment. So that seems like a very hard thing to grasp, and it should be. It took people a long time to understand this is what was going on. But it's true, and this is one of the key mysterious properties of quantum mechanics. And the way we represent this mathematically is we talk about the state of an electron. I'm going to call this strange symbol here representing an electron going through the left slit. And then I'm going to put another symbol for an electron going through the right slit. And the correct statement then, if somebody asks you, what is the state of the electron while it's going from the gun to the screen? Well, the correct answer to that question, it's in both. And its state, now you have this strange possibility then of adding states. So the state of the electron is the sum of a state on the left and the sum of the state on the right. So that's the quantum superposition principle. You just have to accept it. It's true. So the key new idea here is that, you know, you can add the state of an electron. I mean, classically, that's not something you can makes any sense at all. You can say coordinate of a particle is here and a coordinate of a particle is there. Well, it's either one or the other. It doesn't mean it make any sense to add the coordinates. It doesn't give you any physical quantity you can measure. But the quantum state is something that you can add. Okay, so that does sound like a crazy idea, but very quickly people realized the powerful consequences of this idea. It led to a complete understanding of the spectrum of hydrogen, and indeed of the entire periodic table. Within a few years, people had explained the entire periodic table, and optimistically speaking, all of chemistry, high temperature superconductivity, no, we're not there yet, from this principle. Okay, so that's quantum 101. So quantum 102, the second principle I need you to know, is something called quantum entanglement. And this is very similar, except that it involves more than one electron at a time. That's all. It's the same idea of things being added, which you thought had no right to be added together, but involving more than one electron. So here, let me just take the example of a hydrogen atom, which is a proton with an electron running around it. And I'm just going to simplify things greatly. I'm just going to represent the electron by an arrow. And that arrow can point either up or down. So this is what's called the spin of the electron. Electrons spin on their axis. And for quantum mechanical reasons, they can only spin in two directions. They can either spin clockwise or anti-clockwise. So up represents clockwise, and down represents anti-clockwise. So this is an electron spinning in a certain way. OK, so now let me take two hydrogen atoms. That forms a hydrogen molecule. And a very simple picture of what's actually going on in a hydrogen molecule is this picture here. So you have the two hydrogen atoms. So in this state of the two electrons together, one electron is spinning up and the other electron is spinning down. So that's one state. Then there's another state where the first electron is down and the second electron is up. And so if someone asks you the question in this hydrogen molecule, is the left electron up or down? Well, the answer is really both. The correct state is a superposition now of this particular state of the two electrons. When one is up, the other is down, or vice versa. So we say in this case that the two electrons are entangled with each other because the state of one depends on the state of the other. And they're really both in both loops. They're both either up or down, but they're perfectly anti-correlated. If one is up, then the other one is certainly down. Okay, so that's, you can take my word for it, that's what goes on in a hydrogen molecule. Einstein and a few other people decided that this didn't make any sense. And they came up with what's called the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox. They imagined the following thought experiment. Let's take this hydrogen molecule and very carefully separate the two electrons and without disturbing their spin. So you can imagine how you might do that. Just pull them carefully so that you don't disturb their spin. And take one to the moon and keep one here. They should still be in this state. So you separate them really far apart. So I have an atom here with an electron. It's entangled with another atom on the moon. I don't know if it's up or down. But I go in. But I know for sure, if this quantum mechanics is correct, that this is, when this is up, that's down. And if my electron is down, the electron on the moon is up. Okay, so now I go in and look at my electron. Imagine I do that experiment, look at my electron, and what I find that it's down. Then quantum mechanics tell me that instantaneously, at that moment, the electron on the moon must be up. So, and Einstein found this really impossible to believe. He was really a skeptic about quantum mechanics till the end of his life. And he said, this can't possibly be true. How can it be that the electron on the moon knows what I'm doing here? It can't, but seems to. And so that's what's called the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox, where the measurement of one particle can instantaneously determine the state of the other particle. So the answer is, in fact, on this particular problem, Einstein was wrong, although he laid his finger on one of the most beautiful and remarkable properties of quantum mechanics. This kind of experiments have been done, well, not to the moon, but over fairly large distances, and it's been verified many times that indeed what I said will happen. And the way you kind of understand this in your mind is the following ideas. When I talk about the state of this electron here being down, that in itself is not a meaningful statement. There's a state of both electrons, and they share that same state, and the state doesn't live anywhere. It's really common. So there's a kind of a non-locality that the state is not really locally defined. A quantum state can have a long-range nature to it, and it's shared by both electrons. So when you're, because of the interaction in the past, so these two electrons, and they're not any old electron, they have met each other a long time ago, and then you separated them. So when they met each other, they decided to share a state, and then they share it forever until somebody disturbs them. So the state doesn't have a locality, and that's really how you get around this quote-unquote paradox. It doesn't violate any logical principles, so it's not really a paradox. Okay, so that's the end of my introduction to quantum superposition and entanglement. So if you've understood all of that, you're ready to understand high-temperature superconductivity. So I think there'll be a question period at the end, but if there's one burning question, this would be a good point to ask. Anything? Everything is clear? Yes. It can be either. So you can, it all depends on what was controlling the behavior of the electrons earlier. So the question was, does the entanglement, was it manufactured or does it occur naturally? It always occurs. But if you want it to be some particular type of entanglement, you have to carefully design the experiment. Now, what I'm going to say, I mean, that's an excellent question, in fact, that in a superconductor, when you cool it, a very interesting sort of entanglement seems to occur all by itself. You don't have to very carefully set up the wave function of every electron. It just on its own acquires a certain long-range entanglement, as we'll see. All right, so now we're going to take those principles and talk about a few other things. So I've talked about the left side. Now I'm going to return to my favorite material, YVCO, and go back to this quantum critical point and just say a few words about how we are taking these principles and trying to really understand why this material is a superconductor. Okay, so here's so that's what we're going to discuss, and here's the phase diagram again. So it turns out it's useful to start now on the left-hand side in this thing called an antiferromagnet. So what's an antiferromagnet? Well, that's very easy to now describe. So the blue circles here are the copper sites. And remember I told you, you only need to worry about the electrons on those copper sites. And there's one electron on each site at this density. And they form this state. So this is a state, sort of like a chessboard, where the black squares are up and the white squares are down. So that's called an antiferromagnet. And the reason it's called that is if you remove the anti, in a ferromagnet, all the electrons are pointing up, or they're all pointing down. The ferromagnetic iron, that's a good way to think about it. Here, half are up and half are down, but they're in this very beautiful pattern, just like a chessboard. And you can do experiments and really see that's what the electrons are doing on their own at that density of electrons. So what we're going to now do, I'm going to give you a picture of how these electrons start to entangle with each other and just assert that explains almost everything. Well, okay, as best as I can, I'm going to lead you through the logic. So what we want to do as we move in this direction is change the density of electrons. And it turns out that's why this axis is called hole per copper, and that corresponds, this particular axis P corresponds to removing some electrons. So let's start with the antiferromagnet and remove a few electrons. Okay, so you removed some fraction of them. Now, it turns out when you do this, it stops being an antiferromagnet. As you saw, the green region was off to the left. So what do the electrons do? Well, they do pretty much what you saw the pair of electrons in a hydrogen molecule do. They pair up, in this electron, in this EPR type state, Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen, where one is up and the other is down, or vice versa. And from now on, this particular ellipse will represent a pair of electrons doing this. So here's a snapshot of what the electrons might be doing in that material, right there in front of your eyes, if you could look at them, in this regime of hole density. They pair up to form these EPR pairs, or spin, or singlets, or chemical bonds. Let me just call them chemical bonds from now on. And then sometimes they're called Cooper pairs, because of, in honor of Cooper, who first understood the importance of pairing to superconductivity. Okay, once the electrons are paired up, what they don't want to be confined in a given location, but they do want to be paired. So you can imagine that they start moving around. Wait, let me just, sorry, what happened? Okay, right, okay. So now you see that, you know, there, that Cooper pair moved to the left, and that one moved up, this one moved here, and so on. So there's all these possible states for the electrons as pairs moving around. And the actual state of the electron is the sum of all of those. You know, we started with just taking two, left plus right. Now imagine a sum of all of these possible arrangements of these chemical bonds. And really, strictly speaking then, every pair of electron is everywhere at the same time. And that particular state is what's called a Bose-Einstein condensate. So the pair of electrons, those of you who know what bosons are, behaving like a boson, and all bosons in the state where they're everywhere at the same time. So that's the phenomenon, which we understand pretty well now, is what leads to superconductivity. Okay, and I'm teaching a course at Harvard which explains all the equations behind it, which you're welcome to follow online if you want. But that's about as much as I'm going to stay right now. So really, what the name of the game is to make these electrons pair up and then have them move around freely as pairs. They need to move with a partner. The partners need to move together as fast as they can. And if they do that well, you'll get a superconductor. That's, you know, what we've learned since 1957, since what's called the Bardeen and Cooper Schrieffer theory of superconductivity is what's responsible for these amazing properties. Okay, so I've explained roughly what a superconductor is and how it's related to superpositions of pairs of electrons. And sometimes people call that a Bose-Einstein condensate. Okay. All right, but so that's superconductivity. And in fact, this type of superconductivity, in broadly speaking, is also present in aluminum. The only trouble is aluminum goes superconducting at a very low temperature, certainly not anywhere close to liquid nitrogen. I couldn't take a piece of aluminum and do that experiment. I'd need a big laboratory to show you that demonstration. So really the question now is, what about high temperature superconductivity? What makes this happen really easily? So that's of course the question we want to answer, and I'm just going to give you a particular line of thought in current research, which I've been involved in. I don't think it's universally accepted yet, but I think there's a fair amount of evidence that what I'm going to say is at least partly correct. Okay. But of course, I think it's completely correct, but there. All right, so now imagine another process. So far, I've just talked about superposition of pairs of electrons moving around. But now I want the electrons to entangle with each other in a much more subtle way. So just keep your eyes on this pair of electrons. There's four electrons there, and they're paired up in this way. So each electron has a partner, and they form their Cooper pair. Look at these four. So now what those four electrons are going to do is they're going to exchange partners. So they don't actually move, they just exchange partners. So that's a more subtle type of behavior where they're entangling each other in a complicated way, involving the subtle exchange of partners. And so now you can let your imagination run wild and have lots of exchanges of partners without actually moving an electron. So that nothing moved except what was entangled with what. So that's a much more subtle type of entanglement, and eventually you can keep doing this over longer and longer distances, and you get a complicated state with, okay, long-range quantum entanglement. So one of the ideas that many of us are working on is that this type of long-range entanglement or certain flavors of this long-range entanglement of the electrons, when combined with the property of these pairs to move freely, can lead to high-temperature superconductivity. Okay, so that's very much a topic of current research, but there's a lot of evidence from the data, which I'll show you a little bit of data in a minute, that's the picture. So that's the mental picture I want to give you, and I'll just leave it at that. Okay. As I promised, I want to show you some data, and I want to turn to this big question mark. So what about this question mark? So first of all, what we're really interested in is in this special point where this mysterious red region disappears. And the reason is there's a lot of theoretical ideas suggesting that this is where the entanglement is the most extensive, and also, perhaps not coincidentally, where the critical temperature for superconductivity is the highest. So really, that's what we want to understand. And we're going to try to understand this point by approaching it this way. So we're going to focus on that region, and I'm just going to show you some pictures. And really, much of this research was just staring at these pictures for hours and hours until an idea comes to your head. So I'm going to show you some pictures from in this particular density of holes by a tool called scanning tunneling microscopy. So here's my theorist understanding of what goes on in an actual lab. So here's my high-temperature superconductor. And you cool it, and you very carefully bring a very sharp tip connected to some electronics. This is a blown-up version of the trip. These are the copper atoms in YVCO. And this is the tip that you're bringing in, made of some metal. And you bring it really very, very close. Close enough that it's on the order of the dimension size of an atom. And when that happens, when it's really close, you get electrons flowing, depending on the voltage you put, from the tip into the sample or vice versa. You measure that current, and that tells you something about what the electrons are doing at that point. And you can change the voltage and look at electrons with different energy. So it's a beautiful tool because you can look in really atomic resolution at every copper atom, what the electrons are doing. So here's kind of a more realistic picture of what goes on in an actual laboratory. This is a big room with a big hole. All of this is to cool it down to much lower temperatures. It's not as simple as just pouring liquid nitrogen. Everything is stable, so there are these very careful springs and lead-filled tables to prevent all vibration, because you want the tip to be stable to the less than a fraction of the dimension of a single atom. You don't want it to move at all, except when you tell it to move. And then at somewhere in here, very carefully, is a little crystal of YVCO. I think it's somewhere in there with a tip on top of it, and you move the tip around and see what the electrons are doing. All right, so these pictures here that I'm going to show you are from the group of Seamus Davis, J.C. Davis from Cornell University. So when Seamus and his students do this kind of experiment, they come up with pictures like this. So this is only a few hundred angstroms here. This is a very highly magnified picture. You know, your eyes, no way could you see anything with that resolution. Light has a wavelength that's much bigger than the size of this picture. But this tip moving around on the surface of YVCO, or a compound similar to it. It's not exactly YVCO in this particular experiment. So let me just actually blow this up a little bit. So I'll rotate it and zoom in. So that's the kind of picture you see. And those green dots, can everyone see the green dots? The green dots are the copper atom. That's where we know where the coppers are. And so you can see you have subatomic resolution of something, of some electron property, as a function of position. Now, it looks rather messy. Well, that's because these are not perfect crystals. There's always a few impurities, extra atoms sitting around, and that messiness then generates this pattern. Okay, so this particular picture was taken about 7 years ago. It's actually my screensaver, so I've been just looking at it, trying to see some patterns. And after staring at it for 7 years, I'm starting to see some patterns. Now, maybe I'm going insane, but anyway, that's how research goes. You just stare at these pictures and try to figure out what's going on. And in some of our recent work, which is still very recent, but gives you a flavor of what we're thinking about, we think we've seen in these intricate patterns this strange quantum entanglement. You know, so quantum entanglement, it sounded like a far-out idea. It's not something you can see directly in any experiment. We have to look for indirect signatures. And we believe there are certain very subtle signatures in this type of measurement that suggests that this region right next to the highest temperature superconductor has long-range quantum entanglement. So let me go back to that picture. I should have put that picture back again. What I was showing you was in this red region, and that's telling us something about the nature of entanglement and giving us some clues as to why this might be a high-temperature superconductor. That's one set of ideas. There are other ideas, but they all have a similar flavor. People may emphasize different things. But what's certainly true to, I think, generally everyone's thinking about these materials, that this is one of those materials where quantum mechanics is manifesting itself on a macroscopic scale in one of the strangest ways we've seen in any material, involving this EPR paradox really come to life on its own, with millions of electrons at the same time. Okay. All right. That'll keep me inspired to keep working on this. All right. How am I doing on time? Okay. I think I'm doing just fine. So what I've done so far then is explain this box. I've talked about quantum superposition and entanglement, what it is, and how these electrons moving on these ladders of copper sites in YBCO entangle with each other in strange ways that leads to not only this quantum critical point where these patterns that I showed you disappear, but also high temperature superconductivity. All right, so then I come to the last advertised topic. What does this have to do with string theory and black holes? So if you'd shown me this slide, I don't know, about now it's 2007, so about 8 years ago, I'd have said, you're nuts. This shouldn't be here. So what I want to just give you now is a flavor of more recent research where we're bringing a whole new set of tools from a totally unexpected corner of physics to, again, study quantum entanglement. And that those insights on quantum entanglement from study of string theory are influencing our understanding of entanglement in the superconductor, and we hope vice versa too. And this is the kind of thing that perimeter itself is one of the best places to be thinking about, because there are people from both areas in neighboring offices thinking about, you know, want something on this microscopic scale in a scanning microscope to something that's really on the scale of the entire universe. But the same basic principles seem to apply. All right. So that's the reliable part of my talk so far, where I've just talked about experiments in these materials and how we're interpreting them. Now this is the more speculative part, where I'll talk about just wild ideas that seem to be coming together and keeping us excited and perhaps telling us more about how to understand entanglement in crystals. Okay. So that's what I want to do in the remaining time. So here's this picture again of the copper oxygen plane, of the copper plane, where you have these electrons in this wild dance of entanglement, just fluctuating and changing partners and moving around and leading to a high temperature superconductor. So that's a very, you know, hand-waving type picture. So let me try to represent this in another picture that's actually due to Geoffrey Vidal, who's here at the Perimeter Institute. This is a more abstract picture, the kind that mathematicians might like. So abstractly, the way you should think about this picture is that each little circle here is, say, the spin of an electron. The spin is either up or down, or it could also represent whether a given copper site is empty or full. So it's just some local degree of freedom, some quantum degree of freedom. Let's imagine the spin of each electron. So those electrons are sitting there peacefully, but we want to write down or draw a picture of their quantum state. And as I said, the quantum state is the superposition of many configurations. So how do we talk about the picture of such a quantum state? So the one way you imagine you can do it is you take pairs of neighboring electrons, and then you entangle them. You change their degrees of freedom a bit, and by taking linear combinations of different states of the electrons, you can get other states of the electron. And then you combine pairs of electrons to get some combined degree of freedom, like a valence bond. So you have electrons, then you have a valence bond, and do the same thing with valence bond and get a supervalence bond and keep going. So basically the point is that as you go down in this picture, things get more and more entangled and the degrees of freedom become more and more composite. So that axis is what we call depth of entanglement. The actual degree, quantum degrees of freedom sitting here, but we just draw a higher dimensional picture to just have a mental picture of what the electrons are doing. Okay, so just remember that picture now. And now for something completely different. String theory. So I'm sure you've all heard of string theory. What is string theory? Okay. Well, it's a model of all the elementary particles that we know. And the idea is that every elementary particle is a mode of vibration of some really, really tiny string. So each vibration or each note of the string is a different particle. So the fundamental is the electron and so on and so forth, including the Higgs boson, quarks, gravitons, gluons, and other particles that are observed at the CERN accelerator. So why do many physicists get really excited about this model? Well, it has a unique feature that it allows you to combine what's called the standard model of particle physics, all the experiments that you would do at CERN, with Einstein's theory of gravity in a consistent way. And it's really the only theory that does this completely with all the possible degrees of freedom in the standard model. So that's what string theory is, and there's a whole community of people over the last 25, 30 years have been really studying string theory very intensely. And one of the things the string theorists found in their studies was something they call a deep brain. Yeah, I'm sorry for the name, but that's the name. So why is it called a deep brain? Well, it's a particular state of, so you imagine these strings are moving around. So this string moves around, and that's say some represent a wave of light or something. It could be a photon. But imagine that you have a situation where the strings all stick to the end of some surface. And that surface is d-dimensional, and that's why it's called a d-brain. So when string theorists studied this particular phase of string theory, what they found was that if you just followed the blue dots, if you were an ant living on this d-dimensional space, and you didn't know anything about this extra dimension here, then as an ant, you just see these blue circles move around. And if you looked at what they're doing, you'll find that those blue circles have long-range quantum entanglement. In fact, of the type very similar to the quantum critical point that I love so much in YVCO. And this was, just came from a sort of left field, if you wish. String theorists discovered that there were certain states of their beloved strings, which instead of forming the elementary particles under different conditions, they could form this d-brain and have long-range quantum entanglement on the surface of the d-brain. Now I want you to compare this picture. So we are the ants living on the d-brain to this picture from Giffre Vidal. And it's all drawn very suggestively. So here we have, you remember the copper spins are all sitting over here. And we just introduce an extra dimension to describe the entanglement. So now these lines and these pictures, the so-called tensor network, is really very much the same thing as these strings next to a d-brain. So this connection was pointed out by Brian Swingle, and it just gives you an intuitive feeling for why string theory might suddenly tell us something about superconductivity, because it very naturally gives you a different way of thinking about what's happening to particles under conditions of long-range quantum entanglement. And so this particular vertical axis, which is this extra dimension of string theory, having nothing to do with us living on the d-brain, is the same thing then as the depth of entanglement. So from string theory, we then think of this hierarchical structure of entanglement as leading to a theory that lives in one extra dimension. So a new dimension of space-time has suddenly appeared in our mental picture of this quantum state. Of course, we're still living on the surface, though. Anyway. So to put all this together, we have this rather amazing connection, first pointed out by Maldacena at Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, that there is an analogy between states of matter with long-range quantum entanglement in D dimensions, like the electrons on the copper-oxygen plane in two dimensions, and string theory and gravity in one higher dimension. And that extra dimension has to do with the depth of entanglement. So the more entangled your state is, the more real, in a sense, this extra dimension becomes. Okay. Right. So that's really the reason, certainly, string theory. So I'm really interested in this. I want to build a better superconductor. But perhaps, you know, we're happy to try anything. Perhaps this set of ideas will give us new ways of thinking about what's going on here. So that's another very active avenue of current research. Okay. So then you can ask, so this is what many of us have been working on the past few years. Can you now take Einstein's theory of general relativity, which, remember, is just a classical theory. It knows nothing about quantum mechanics. Einstein himself was not happy with quantum mechanics. But amazingly, his own theory, when interpreted in this way, when interpreted by reducing its dimension, became a quantum theory of states of matter, perhaps like what's in the high-temperature superconductors. So can you find... Now, of course, this is, at this point, a very general connection. I hasten to emphasize that doesn't mean that I can solve Einstein's theory of relativity and make a better superconductor. We're a long way from that. But it's just giving us another playground in which to understand the physics of entanglement a bit better. So you can ask, are there solutions of Einstein's general relativity which correspond to superconductors and strange metal? And the answer, I guess I didn't bother put it up, is yes, indeed, there are examples. They're still rather bizarre examples, and we're still trying to understand more things about them, with the aim of ultimately saying more about YVCO. Okay, so that's the connection then between string theory and long-range entanglement. So the final buzzword is black hole. So what's it got to do with black holes? Well, black holes, what are black holes? Well, black holes are, well, there's one, are basically very dense objects. So if you took our sun and really compressed it, I forget, to the size of a tennis ball, or I don't remember, then it would become a black hole. And it's so heavy that light basically curves and falls back, can't really escape a black hole. So, and this was one of the amazing predictions of Einstein's theory of general relativity, that there are these solutions called black holes, and if you know the mass of any astrophysical object, this is Newton's constant, and this is the velocity of light. It gives you a radius, which is called the Schwarzschild radius, and if you compress any mass smaller than this radius, it'll become a black hole. Okay, so this was a theoretical idea coming up in the 30s, but today, of course, we have many astrophysical examples of objects just like this. Okay, so but the story from 1930s jumps to 1974, when Hawking really made one of his most famous contributions. He started to think about what we would say in today's language, the nature of entanglement near a black hole. And so now, you can say, imagine the following thought experiment. Let me go back to the beginning of my lecture to this hydrogen molecule. And, you know, I told you about Einstein's thought experiment of separating them with one electron here and the other on the moon. But now, well, let's do the same thing and put one inside a black hole and one outside a black hole. Why not? Since you're doing thought experiments. So now you have the situation that something inside a black hole, which you thought you could never talk to because no signal can ever come out, light itself goes back, is actually knows something about what's going on outside. So that's, you know, long-range quantum entanglement, as long-range as you can make it, because it's reached a region you can't even talk to. At least they can't talk to you. You can send signals in there. But anyway, so there's this then turns out to be another arena where you to think about long-range quantum entanglement. There's long-range quantum inside and outside of a black hole. And in fact, there are even special black hole solutions that look sort of like superconductors and strange metals and in some very loose sense, like some of the properties of YVCO. But that's, I should have a lot of caution in that, but it's still a very amazing connection in physics. We're thinking about Hawking's work on how horizons have this very strange entanglement properties may tell us something about properties of metals and superconductors. All right, I guess I've already said that. All right, so I guess that's pretty much the end of my presentation. So the main idea, I hope everybody remembers, is what is superposition and what is entanglement? Really very simple, and hopefully I showed you in pictures. And then I showed you connections between these simple ideas and what's happening in superconductors, perhaps, and then even stranger ideas on how entanglement near black holes may even shed light on all these pictures. So thank you very much.
Okay, we will open the floor to questions. The in-studio audience, there's a microphone right here. You can just cue behind it. And the online audience, the questions have started to flow in, so I'll start there. So Chris from Physics is Awesome, it's a Facebook page. He says, how long do you think it will be until we can use high-temperature superconductors on large scale?
Well, excellent question. I mean, I think the basic technology is there, but there's a huge startup cost. If you want to replace, say, power cables under New York, if you were to do that today from scratch, it might even pay to do it with high-temperature superconductors. But, you know, there's all that existing technology, so it's going to be a while before this, you know, this infrastructure builds up, and there's also a chicken and egg problem because you need enough of a market to make it, and so on. So I think there's an experiment in Seoul right now where they're actually using under Seoul ITC cables for, at least there's a plan to use ITC cables for long distance power transmission. And there are also, I think, plans for various MRI machines and so on. But it's been rather slow, yes. The discovery of these materials was 1987, but there's a lot of technical hurdles and also financial hurdles and so on. But I'm not directly involved in this, but that's that's what I hear.
Thank you.
That doesn't stop us, of course. It's still fun to think about what's going on in these materials.
Great.
And many people around the world are doing that.
Let's go to the microphone.
Hi. Thank you so much for the interesting lecture. I have two questions. I'll ask the first and then maybe not be greedy. But talking about your double slit experiment,
yes.
And you talked about sending individual electrons through the slits, mm-hmm. and you'd end up with an interference pattern that would occur over time.
Yes, correct.
Right?
Correct.
Discreetly.
Yes.
So I was wondering, have you ever sent entangled electrons through the double slits? And if so, do you sort of get maybe an immediate wave sort of pattern that increases intensity over time, or what would?
Well, that's a really really original and creative idea. I don't think people. No. I'm very serious. What you're saying is correct. That if you send entangled electrons, you may see the interference right away. But I think people may have done analogs of that experiment, where you take a wire with entangled electrons and then you send it around what's a slit, but you split the wire in two and then watch the current come out the other way. There are analogs of that I think have been done, and again, consistent with the basic principle of superposition.
Okay, I'm going to ask my other question, but you can answer theirs first. This is about superconductivity. So I understand how you're talking about long-range entanglement. You have a specific density of copper at electrons.
Right.
But what you didn't explain, and it would help, I think, a lot of us, is when you have superconductivity, the idea is to pass electricity very effectively.
Right.
And you efficiently. And you talked about, in this case, there was no heat produced, so there'd be no line losses.
Right.
So could you explain at the end how you pass electricity over a superconductor and why the long-range entanglement makes it such an efficient process?
Let's answer that now.
Excellent question. And if I, well, I can answer the first part. If I could answer the second part, you know, I'd be having a party. But okay. The first part, so why is a superconductor transmit electricity without resistance? So remember I told you about this Bose-Einstein condensate, where pairs of electrons were everywhere at the same time. So that's a state where each electron, each pair of electron, each Cooper pair, is in a superposition state where you have, you know, Cooper pairs here, there, and so on. So once they're in this complicated superposition state, if you just tilt the potential a little bit, that state can very easily flow. So they're already everywhere, so just having them move a little bit is not that difficult. So that's the rough answer. But that's exactly the point that, in fact, I'm covering in my lectures in my graduate course right now. But that's what I can do without just by waving my hands. The second question is really, of course, also an excellent question. Why does quantum entanglement lead to higher temperatures? Well, so let me try to answer the best I can. So to get superconductivity, you need the electrons to form pairs. And so they have to have some reason for coming near each other and pairing up. And what we understand is that long-range quantum entanglement enhances that process. It makes it much more likely that they form pair because, they're entangled, and so why not? You gain some energy from being entangled, so why not actually form pairs and move too? Okay, so that's very much a topic of current research, though. So excellent questions.
Great. Let's go in studio one more time.
Thank you. Just got a question about, so if you have two electrons that are paired and separated by any amount of distance, and you were to look at them both at the exact same time, I understand that you're going to have one going up, one going down.
Yeah.
While you're both looking at them, are you able to change the status of one of them to see instantly on the other end to allow for a simple binary communication so that you can have instantaneous communication over any distance? Is that possible to change while you're looking at it?
Well, excellent question again. So first of all, no matter how you do the experiment, it'll come out consistent. So I'm here and you're on the moon. We can share clocks any way we want. We'll do the experiment and then we'll meet later and I'll tell you I saw up, you'll say I saw down. So we'll be consistent no matter what. Mm-hmm. So that's the first answer. But secondly, when I saw up, you don't know I saw up.
Right.
Okay, so even though I know at that point you're going to see down, you don't know that. I haven't told you that. So there is no real information that's gone instantaneously. However, this particular idea can be used for secure communication. You know, you have to combine this particular EPR pair with one phone call or something. So I have to call you up and tell you, okay, if you saw up, the Red Sox won, and if you saw down, the Yankees won. And you know, anybody listening in has no idea what I'm saying. But I know I saw down, so I know what you saw, and so I've sent a message to you.
So not so much communication, more of a security.
Secure, so you can use it for secure communication. And that's, in fact, a practical application that you can, there are companies that sell you machines that will do that.
Thank you. We'll take one Twitter question, and then we'll go to the studio for the last question. So the Twitter question is, and this comes at it, I think, from a different direction, perhaps, could string theory be proven using superconductors?
Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to laugh. Excellent question. No, the question I usually get is string theory right? Well, you know, string theory is an amazing, beautiful mathematical structure. It's probably one of the greatest achievements of mathematics and physics, and it's entirely consistent in its whole structure. So when people ask, is string theory right, or can string theory be proven, what they're really asking is it the actual theory of what's going on at CERN? Are there really strings inside an electron? We don't know. So that's an experimental question. It's going to require much more careful experimentation at even higher energies to tell the answer. So we don't really know what happened to the Big Bang. Now, this you may have heard of the BICEP experiment with these signals coming from the right from the Big Bang. Interpreting signals like that could tell you something about whether string theory was relevant right at the Big Bang. But that's a physics question. That's an experimental question, not a question of whether string theory is right or wrong. I mean, string theory, or can be proven. String theory, all the evidence is that it's correct, that it's got a beautiful internal structure, very amazing. And we're just using that structure. We're not proving anything about the universe. We're just using that structure and the mathematical relationships between different phases of string theory to understand something about quantum entanglement in a different regime.
Thank you. Okay. And let's finish with the final question from in studio.
Yeah, so in the same way that quantum, the superposition is destroyed in the double slit experiment, and the interference pattern is eliminated by illuminating electrons.
Yes.
In a superconductor, if you were to illuminate the pairs, entangled pairs that are in a superposition state with, say, something like a bath of X-rays.
Sure.
Would this destroy the superposition of the pairs of entangled?
Sure.
And would it then destroy the superconductivity?
Well, a sufficiently intense beam of X-rays could, yes. But any measurement is collapsing the entanglement locally in some way that you would do of these electrons. I mean, also, it's true, you know, that piece of YBCO is sitting in the environment, so it's being heated up by all the atoms in the room, and all of that thermal perturbations is screwing up the entanglement. And that's the reason you have to cool it. You have to cool it to allow the entanglement to grow, roughly speaking.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Dr. Subir Sanchez.